there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there. Welcome to On the Wing podcast, brought to you by Purina Pro Plan. Since 1955, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources wildlife and enforcement personnel have conducted an annual August roadside survey of wildlife during the first 2 weeks of August. Today, in his own living room, pool room, billiards. We should play, be the first billiards game on the podcast. I'm joined by Minnesota DNR's wildlife section manager, Dave Traba. Did I pronounce it correctly?
You got it, Bob. All very right. Good.
To explain the ins and outs of August roadside counts with, obviously, a specific look at what they mean for pheasants, but there's a lot of roadside counts this time of year for all sorts of species, so we'll put our focus on pheasants and we'll talk about Minnesota, but there's applications for quail country and all across Minnesota, the nation's pheasant country as well. So Dave, thank you for inviting me into your home. It looks like you might be a hunter.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, and like we were talking, Bob, we just moved into this new house here a month ago. So I tell people we're 80% moved in. There's some boxes out in the garage you can help me with later getting them moved in. And this weekend I just got, if you will, the man cave all suited up and ready. But, we'll kind of talk about how we ended up here in central Minnesota from the prairies of western Minnesota and just a little bit on my background. But, no, it's a pleasure to be here. It's good to talk about our work we do within the Minnesota DNR, and I think we'll have fun.
So you still have some boxes to unpack, but the taxidermy is all in place.
Yeah, that's right.
You've got some beautiful whitetails. Tell me about the shotgun you got a hammer.
Yeah, that's the muzzleloader. That's
it is a muzzleloader.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a muzzleloader. So these deer were taken that you see here with that muzzleloader. That one there is the Daydream buck. That one's the faulty cap buck. That one took two tries. The first cap was a dud. He allowed me to get another cap on. That was a 2 p.m. buck. This was the 10:30 in the morning buck with minus 40 wind chills. All these are public land deer.
Wow.
They're all taken on the beautiful Lac Parle WMA, and where I was a manager for 24 years. So I had the insider secret where all the big deer were.
And you have a Labrador retriever outside.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I imagine you know where a few birds are on.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder, why did you leave that beautiful piece of property? But a little bit about my background, Go Packers. Go Packers. I grew up in Wisconsin, in the southeast part of the state. Like I tell people, Bob, it was, when you think of Wisconsin, it was classic. It was red dairy barns and dairy cows on corn and alfalfa.
Okay.
Seriously, I did not know what soybean plant was until I moved to Minnesota. Hmm. It was corn and alfalfa. And if my wife grew up on a dairy farm. I grew up, my dad was a postmaster in a small town of Theresa. So we knew, if you will, knew everyone. Great, great place to grow up. But we were nestled between Horicon Marsh, Wildlife Refuge, and the Theresa Marsh. So, hey, I was around a lot of waterfowl abundance, grew up in a hunting family. So we hunted waterfowl hard. But my introduction to pheasant hunting was through us, a Rod and Gun Club, game farm birds. We raised our own birds. They let them go out on different properties, and that's what we did on the weekends.
Hmm.
And it didn't dawn on me, like game farm birds and all that stuff, right? But that was my fondest memories will always be hunting with my grandpa and my dad and my brothers for pheasants. And again, as a youngster, 12 years old, I never thought about oh, these are game farm birds, they're not wild birds. I was just out with my family hunting birds over dogs. You know, we had Chesapeakes, we had Labs, and, you know, and I'm kind of carrying on that tradition. My son went with some long-haired thing, you know, but we're a lab family.
Except for your son.
Except for my son. Wait, so.
Is it a long-haired bird dog?
Yeah,
it is. It like an English setter?
No, it's a wire hair.
Okay.
A wire hair. And a great dog on that.
But. He's just an outcast now.
Yeah, just, anyways, and I can, as I get older, I can appreciate that dog, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to run behind him. But, yeah, I mean, so it was that exposure, you know, so it's going to be a very familiar story, maybe to some of your listeners. But, again, that being in the outdoors, family and hunting, we deer hunted. You know, what my career path, I'll remember to this day, I was a sophomore. I was in study hall, and I looked up, and there was a poster of, I didn't know it at the time, but Jack Massapus, and he was holding two black bear cubs.
Hmm.
And I looked at that poster, and it was College of Natural Resources, UW-Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Pointers.
Pointers, you bet. And he's holding two bear cubs. I looked at that and said, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want that career.
Hmm.
And a few years later, I was enrolled. A few years later, I was actually doing black bear research under Raymond K. Anderson at UW-Stevens Point. I would study black bear ecology up on the Apostle Island National Lakeshore.
So really?
So for three summers, I lived in a tent, hiked 15 miles a day, checking the traps for bears, hauled in all the... I am just amazed today and jealous of researchers today that can put on, you know, transmitters where they get GPS signals. And that wasn't the way it was back in the day. You had to be living out there with the bears to get the triangulation and the habitat stuff.
When you say Apostle Island's National Lakeshore, were you... on the islands?
Yeah, I was on Stockton Island, which is...
How many bears are on the islands in the
Apostle? Oh, when we...
So for folks that are listening in Georgia, right, like the Apostle Islands are in Lake Superior.
Yeah, there's an archipelago, you know, a cluster of 21 islands off of Bayfield, kind of off the tip of Wisconsin, out in Lake Superior. And interesting, Jack Massapus, we talked about, we kind of felt he caught the first male, the first boar and female on that island, the sow.
Hmm.
And then he's kind of studied that population for a while. Then I came in there and picked it up.
Hmm.
And I want to say when I left, there was around 20 bears. And then I actually think it kept climbing higher and higher.
Hmm.
But the interesting part of that study is that there was no human food, right? So these bears made their living on natural foods. Whereas most studies on black bear populations throughout the United States, there's agriculture. There's human garbage, you know, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's bias. So this was a very unique look.
Yeah.
And we started seeing some things. I mean, a lot of the yearlings were like half the weight of what you would find on the mainland of Wisconsin. Really in poor health.
Huh.
There was some, I believe, cannibalism going on towards the end. You know, bears killing other bears, which is almost unheard of.
Yeah.
Again, that was a little bit harder to piece in. We did, but we had very few animals, bears, leave the island.
Huh.
But we did have one that, and we actually have photos of them swimming across. That would be, going off memory here, about 3 miles of swimming in Lake Superior. You probably hopped on Oak Island. Then it was like another, don't quote me, another 5 miles of swimming to hit the mainland.
Yeah, I was thinking it. I was like, oh, well, what about in the winter when it's frozen? They're hibernating. So they wouldn't take the easier route because they're sleeping. So a 3 mile swim across Lake Superior, they must not get hypothermic then.
No, they got that big old layer of fat on them and the thick coat. But
what would be their natural food that time? Because I'm assuming they're eating berries
in
the summer.
It was,
but in the spring, like until fawn, there's also whitetails there, right?
No, so there's no whitetails.
So they're not eating fawns.
No, they're not.
What are they eating?
I mean, it was pretty much, you know, a lot of insects, a lot of green vegetation. There's old beaver flowages.
Okay.
We actually, there was a Doug Smith of famous Yellowstone wolf reintroduction, was actually doing his master's work on beaver ecology on Outer Island without bears. Stockton Island had bears.
Huh.
He almost had to quit his work on Stockton Island because our bears were checking his traps before he was.
Oh, wow.
So... And actually, I actually believe bears were probably killing beavers regardless of the trapping, because we were finding on Outer Island the beavers were actually foraging further away to get aspen than on Stockton Island. And we know from Voyageurs National Park and other studies now that bears and wolves are probably taking more beavers than we ever thought possible.
Yeah,
and your listeners are probably wondering when we're going to get the pheasants. we're going to get there, Bob.
Yeah, I took a study. This is super interesting.
But back to that. I mean, so really those bears relied on the beaver flow just because that's where you had that open canopy in the forest. So that's where the berries were at.
Mm.
And then the rest of Stockton Island was a lot of red oak forest.
Oh, acorns.
Acorns, exactly. And they made their living on acorns. And one thing that would all frustrate me was I'd go out there about times acorns were setting. I'd be on the island all summer, then I would come off for classes, then during the weekends I'd go up there and check on the bears, you know, again. And I'd get, if you will, more mortality signals, and what it would, and then it would go into active mode. But what it is, the radio collars would be stuck up in the, you know, 50 feet up in a red oak tree. And so the bears would be up there feeding on the acorn before they drop, and then they would get a branch through, then they would slip their collars.
Wow.
So I'd go, and it, you know, and to me that was just, that was devastating, because the man hours that went in to capture that bear.
Right.
And, you know, again, we were hiking 15 miles a day, checking our traps, coming back, and then we're doing all the telemetry. So just
how many collars did you lose in oak trees?
Well, I think two or three going off memory. It was enough to be like, oh, come on.
But well, what's interesting, like, to bring it back to pheasants, I mean, in what we're talking about, August roadside counts, data and science are important.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, when you lose that data set, it would be akin to not doing an August roadside survey for a year or two, right? You lose that data set, you might be able to pick it up, but yet you have that gap in there and that long running. But regardless, so my dream job, we're getting here, folks.
Yeah.
My dream job was to be a Northern Forest Wildlife Manager. Huh. That's what I wanted to do. So I finished up my master's degree's work, and then I worked more with black bears. I actually took a job up in Ely, Minnesota with the Forest Service studying blackbird ecology up in the Superior National Forest. So, folks, that's what took me from Wisconsin and Pointer and moved me over here into Minnesota. And my wife and I comment on that we have now lived in Minnesota longer than we have in Wisconsin. But we're still Packer fans. That's something you don't.
There's
you
know. Your true line.
There's some things you don't across. But so I loved the job with the Forest Service. It was kind of more of a temporary gig. You know, I kind of felt it wasn't going to last forever. But we moved up there, my wife and son, who's now 2 years old. And I look back on it. I mean, we moved with two pickup trucks and a little trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved down here, it was a semi, you know. And up there for, you know, back then everything's all relative, for $7.25. And I thought I won the lottery.
Mm.
But my wife reminded me that we're really poor. Time to get a real job.
Mm.
So the real job started where I'll start applying for a wildlife position with the Minnesota DNR.
Mm-hmm.
And position opened up at Lacaparl WMA, and I had applied for a turkey job and one other one. Oh, yeah, I think about Thief Lake. And, you know, hey, Dave, you did a really good job. Stick with it, but we have, you know, someone else in mind. I was like, okay. And
yeah.
But anyway, then I applied for Lacaparl, and a few days later I got the phone call, and I'm like, well, where's Lacaparl? You know, like that. And they, for your listeners, that's the – it's one of our eight major units. It's located in the upper Minnesota River Valley, and it's most famous for Canada geese. That's where the restoration of Canada geese, both giant and migratory Canada geese, really, when you think of Lacaparl, you think of waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I landed as a young assistant manager in January of 1992, which just, you know, I look back, so I got a 33-year career with the DNR. I love my time at Lacaparl, and that's where, hey, listen, we're getting there on pheasants because I was able to witness tremendous waterfowl migrations. I had tremendous hunting opportunities. We were managing, you know, wetlands and grasslands. We had a control goose hunt, just loved all our time of it. But that area, that Upper Minnesota River area, is just blessed with public lands, and it's grasslands. So for those listeners, the whole western one-third of Minnesota is tall grass prairie, if you will.
Yeah.
Then as you move further east, you get the transition zone, and then eventually you get up in Arrowhead to get more into the northern forest, boreal forest part. So great diversity in Minnesota. Like I tell people, I can be, you know, hunting pheasants down in southwest part of state, drive in if you want to power through for 6-7 hours, I could be up looking at a moose up in that Ely area all in the same day. So just great variety in that. And but, you know, for your listeners there, Lac La Parle, major unit, over 30,000 acres. You got Big Stone National Wildlife Refuge. Around there is over 100,000 acres of public land. The waterfall management areas, you got, well, excuse me, your waterfall production areas, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service administered. Then you got our WMAs, wildlife management areas run by the state. The other one's federal. And again, by the visionary of previous managers going out there and acquiring these properties. But it was just a great place to work. We did, I think, just with our team, we did some fabulous things for native prairie management, grazing systems, protect a lot of native sod from being converted. But the story there is with those grassland based, the pheasant hunting was tremendous. And, you know, so we had great waterfall hunting. Go out, finish waterfall hunting in the morning, go chase pheasants the rest of the day, and then maybe be in the deer stand later on. And I always wanted to try to pull off the trifecta or fourfecta, whatever it's called, where go out and shoot some ducks in the morning, hunt pheasants. I always wanted to get a deer and then check, you know, catch some walleyes the same day. If you could pull that off, that's pretty good.
Living right.
Didn't quite get there. So.
And it, so after Lac La Parle, did you became the region manager?
When Ken Varwin, he was the regional wildlife manager. When a regional wildlife manager for your folks, that person oversees an area, so like southwest part of the state. And region 4, we have 4 regions in Minnesota. Region 4 covers 32 counties in the southwest part of the state, right?
Gotcha.
So Ken Varwin was my supervisor, and that our regional office was in New Ulm, Minnesota. So when he retired, or getting close to retirement, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Dave, I think you're ready." Like, now, Ken, I'm real happy right here.
Yeah,
we got a lot going on. We get to just, you know, finishing up a big lake restoration project. I'm like, life's too good, you know. Excuse me here. So, anyways, a few weeks later, he came back and said, "Nah, Dave, seriously, I think you're ready." And I lost a lot of sleep, and it, you know, because that's where our kids grew up there. Got a son and daughter, and that's where we had a lot of friends. Life was good. But, you know, I guess I realized I was ready for change. So I said, yeah, you know, I had to apply and got the regional job. And I quickly realized I really loved it. It was looking at the good work our staff do day in and day out with our partners, Pheasants Forever, the Nature Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited, right? Everyone working together to do good things for wildlife and good things for wildlife habitat on the landscape. And I'm like, yeah, this is, now I got to oversee that, right? So I all looked at it as a problem solver. Staff would come up saying, "Hey, Dave, I got this issue going on. Help to solve them. Get them the resources they need to go out and succeed in their jobs." And I really just enjoyed that aspect. So I was doing that for 9 years. And then when Kelly Straka, our previous section manager, got tapped on the shoulder to take the division director job, I was tapped like, "Hey, Dave, excuse me, what about applying for the section manager position?" And this time, Bob, I didn't hesitate. I'm like, you know what? The ability to take kind of that mentorship, problem solver for the region and do that statewide, yeah, count me in. Cool. And now I get to go back to my dream job of Northern Forest. So now I, at times, I get to talk about forest issues and elk and moose and all that stuff, too. So.
Bears, pheasants,
yeah, exactly.
Grouse, sharptails, you name it. You everything. It's throughout, from Lac La Parle to region to now section, August roadside counts have been part of that scope during that entire path, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. So August roadside survey, for people that maybe aren't familiar with them.
So we'll dive into that.
Okay.
Let me mention and thank Purina Pro Plan. I'm proud to recognize Purina Pro Plan as the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Wildlife Habitat Mission and the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. All of my pups eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the Wildlife Habitat Conservation Mission of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, which is important to me, but most important is Purina Pro Plan has a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. You can learn more at ProPlansport.com. Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. So I didn't mean to cut you off but it was a perfect transition to, you know, we go from your from your career to let's talk a little bit about August Roadside Counts, you know, the theory and reality.
Yeah.
So you were saying what they are. So go ahead and tell us, you know, overview of what they mean.
Yeah, it's August Roadside Survey for here in Minnesota. It started back in 1955. So I even hate, you know, have to do the math on that. I'm not good at math, but readers can. And when I got to look at my notes here a little bit. So they're really, we have 170 routes statewide. And Bob, 149 of them are within what we consider the Pheasant Range of Minnesota.
Okay.
And a typical August Roadside Survey segment, it's 25 miles in length.
Okay.
And we have traditionally 1 to 4, maybe 5 of them per county, right?
And I would have thought there'd be more in some kind. But.
Well, but yeah, it's kind of broken up by we have how many zones here? We have a West Central, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 different blocks, West Central zone. So now sometimes we'll get into this in more detail. Right, the pheasant hunters will really kind of hang their hat and like, how are the pheasants doing in Brown County, right? And so we'll produce a map.
Yep, color-coded. You know,
a color-coded map, which is kind of showing good, fair, poor. And really for your listeners to understand really the power of the August Roadside Survey, you got to take all those different transects and kind of combine them together by the different block, like I said, the West Central, the East Central, the South Zone, the South Central Zone, etc., right? Because that's where you get the statistical power. Our biometricians ran it. They would say, Dave, we run these 25 segments once, right? They would say you would have to run them, every segment, 10 times to be able to get a little bit of power and understanding at the local level. So I want our listeners across the nation really to realize it's really taking those 25 mile segment ramp per county and then combining them within those larger blocks, if that makes sense.
Okay, so a 25 mile route.
Yep.
And it's run one singular time in August.
Yes. Okay. Yep. And so some managers, right, so for most of our area wildlife managers, they have a geographic work area. And that might be some of them have 3 counties. Some of them have as many as 6 to 7 counties. So if you have 1 to 4 routes per county, let's take it by 3 counties, 9. That's 9 survey routes in a 2-week period. Ideally, we want these run from 1 to, I think, like 15 August is when we hope to have these surveys completed. So you got to take in some days aren't going to be good weather-wise, right? And so that when this comes out, it's like game on for our wildlife staff to get these surveys done.
So how many surveys are run by the exact same person? Running multiple, or is it just depending?
Nope, everyone is, we try to have the same observers do the same routes year after year.
So if, but it, for you, like say you're in Lacaparo County, are you going to run 3 different surveys in a 14-day period?
Yeah, I think our managers are running multiple surveys in those counties. And that would include their assistant managers as well. Again, if they have 9 survey blocks, they're divvying them up. And sometimes by county, like, hey, Wendy, you're going to have Lincoln County. Amber, you're going to have Lyon County, et cetera.
Right.
You know, we kind of break that out.
And it's so some of these folks are biologists.
Yes.
And some of the folks, are they enforcement?
Yep, we also, yeah, we'll tap our local conservation officers on the shoulder. And then we even have a few that I think are volunteers, actually Pheasants Forever volunteers that will run to help us in some of our remote counties where staff are just, you know, spread thin, right? Mm-hmm. If, you know, and there's times where we'll have staffing vacancies, so sometimes we got to ask, you know, volunteers or other people to step in short term. But, Bob, I think to your point, we try to have the same people run the same routes year after year because there, you get consistency with that data set. When you change observers, in my mind, you're introducing a little bit of bias, right?
A little variable there.
Yeah, there's another variable there. So I think the more that we can reduce the variables, and these are the same routes year after year.
Mm-hmm.
We don't take a random different 25 miles. Now I think we all have them GPSed in. You know, back in the day, it was you had to look down at your paper map to say, oh, I'm at mile number one. Now we got computer systems that can kind of help us track where we're at on the line segments a little bit easier.
So that I was thinking about that. It started in 1955, and you're running the same routes year after year. There has to be some variability because even in rural Minnesota, you know, some of those gravel roads are now blacktop highways. Maybe they're going through urban areas. Are they truly the identical routes since 1955? Or is there just, you know, largely the same with some little variation?
I would say in the more rural areas of Minnesota, yep, there they are,
the same routes.
Yep,
well,
they're the same routes. But to your point, in the more urban areas where rural gave way to suburbia, gave way to, you know, more comprehensive, we have abandoned some survey routes, and then we replaced them with some other ones and stuff. So you're right, some township roads. We really need gravel roads. A paved road is not conducive. It just gets with the grit, and we want the birds out there sunning. If you get too much traffic, yeah, you might as well go home, right?
Yeah.
You know, and even out in the rural areas of Minnesota, it'd be like, oh, come on, you know. and that's, you know, that's one thing where, well, my point is, you know, you're driving at 10 miles an hour. Someone passes you.
Yeah.
You just know they're probably bouncing pheasants off the road. And again, it's not, we'll get into it, it's just not pheasants. We're really looking at a whole range of wildlife. When we think of this as a pheasant survey, and I think it was primarily set up for that, but we're looking at gray partridge. You know, we added cranes to the list. We added white-tailed deer. We were like, well, can we get an index? That's abundance of white-tailed deer, you know, and we're seeing more cranes. Well, gee, how many sandhill cranes, and where are they spread across the state? And you got, so it's really almost sensory overload when you're going down there because you're really kind of recording everything that you see. I think we're even recording house cats and dogs, you know. Oh, there was a cat, right? Take note of that.
Uh-huh.
So, but, you know, so it's kind of that long team, you know, and really the power of it is, to me, it gives you an index of wildlife abundance on the landscape. I think of it, I would tell someone, it's like going in for a health check with your doctor. It's like, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
I look at the results and be like, how is the farmland of Minnesota doing? If numbers are down, consistently down, we got a problem. There's something's wrong, right? Habitat.
Sure.
If, you know, I always feel better if we got, you know, numbers are trending up, we're seeing abundance of wildlife, we're seeing good brood sizes. That's a pretty good checkup, right?
Sure.
So one thing for your listeners, we don't use the August Roadside Survey to set pheasant hunting regulations, right? It's pretty bulletproof. You're shooting just males.
Yeah.
So we're not like, oh, geez. Our numbers are like waterfall, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you know, we got adaptive harvest management. We got so many ponds. We got so many mallards that equals X on this. We're going to have a moderate liberal season. That's not the case with pheasants. I don't know of anywhere. Well, I'll stick to Minnesota. I'm not sure about other states, right? But, you know, we have a long history of two birds, and then, you know, we finally went to three birds
in December.
And maybe we'll revisit that. You know, we're going to be talking about the pheasant hunters and what their attitudes are. So maybe we'll see some changes in the future. But back to this, again, excuse me, we're not using it so much. We're not using it all to set regulation. But, again, it's just giving that index of how things are doing and the pulse in all wildlife populations. But I can say if we, you know, I think over time we know that brood sizes are trending smaller, not as many chicks per brood. There are signals in that August roadside data that can then feed us that, hey, maybe we need to do some research on this aspect and try to figure out what's going on with the population. And if you don't have that long-term data set, I think you can miss some of those signals that you wish you would have and stuff.
So, I hadn't heard that there's a signal of smaller brood sizes. Do you have a hypothesis as to why that would be?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I worked on prairie girls too. We're seeing it there. I just think it's our landscape is just becoming more, I'll just call it what it is. It's just more intense land use. Everything seems to have a purpose nowadays. There's not the odd areas. The agricultural fields certainly aren't what they were like back in the 1950s. You just don't see small grains on the landscape. You know, infield weed control is taken to the next level. Water isn't held on the landscape. I just don't think it's as conducive to being good brood habitat as it was at one time and stuff. So
okay,
there are some exceptions.
So
to
chicks
that
are more vulnerable. So
yeah,
you see,
I just think, yeah.
Or it also could be a function of maybe hens are nesting a little bit earlier.
Yeah,
and if they lose a nest and they have to re-nest, there's going to be less eggs in the second or third nest. So that could chicks, right?
Yeah, and it gets down to the health of the hen, right? You know, and how many eggs and weight of the eggs and all that stuff. And it all relates into chicks and stuff. And like I said, where I work with, you know, prairie biologists too, or prairie grouse biologists, it's definitely a signal in that too. I just think it's just, you know, we have a very intensive land use nowadays and stuff. So, but those are, you know, I think that's the beauty of the August roadside surveys. You can, you know, see those trends over time. You know, another thing we can use on that data set is when we look at, you know, we have our managers are estimating what the age is of the chicks that they're seeing. You know, is it 1 to 2, you know, et cetera, 6 to 8, whatever. Then we can kind of backdate that and look at where the peak hatch was.
Sure.
And maybe it's changed, but it was always around 4 June. That was the peak hatch. When I think of the critical time for hatching, it was early, like the first week of June. Think of it that way. But I think with, you know, changing climates and stuff like that, I think that data set over time, too, we can go back and look. One, has that peak hatch timing changed over time, right? And, again, I think that's the power of this data set where you can look back and say, well, what was the conditions here in the 50s and how it's changed through time? Without the status that you wouldn't have it. Same thing with tracking, you know, change of migration at Lac Parle for waterfall. We could see the change, you know, first migratory geese started arriving when Arwen Anderson on the 13th of September. When I arrived at Lac Parle, it was the 13th of October. When I left Lac Parle, it was almost the 13th of December.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, so if we didn't keep track of that stuff, you know, well nothing's changed. Well, yeah. You know,
things
geese,
are changing.
Geese are arriving 2 months later than they used to. That's a change, folks, right? So
yeah.
It's the same thing with up and game birds and migration. So,
thinking about the mechanics a little bit more, do the people that are doing these roadside counts, do they have to go through a training of any sort? Or are they, because they're biologists and conservation officers, they know what a crane looks like?
No, we don't have a formal training, if you will. I mean, we give out survey guidelines, right? When we give out, you know, protocols and on the criteria, we'll get into this, but what criteria do we need to be able to run these? And I would expect that our, you know, our managers are coaching, you know, the young assistants, if you will, on the mechanics of running the August roadside survey. But I think you alluded to, we don't give any eye tests.
I asked that in jest, but I mean, I've worked in baseball before, so we've had some umpire jokes.
Yeah,
Time. But I mentioned to you, like, there's an old story about a grouse drumming person who, after that gentleman retired, the new person counted drumming counts, rough grouse drumming counts, went off the charts. And they learned after the fact, let's call him George. Old George was actually pretty deaf.
Yeah.
And they, you know, he wasn't getting accurate counts. So I was curious, like, is there any sort of recognition of different species because it is more than pheasant? And is there an eye test for being able to drive down a gravel road and be like, well, that's a, you know, that's a brood of pheasants and not meadowlarks, you know?
You know, we actually have hearing tests within our agency now, but not related to that. But, you know, Bob, I think you bring up an honest point. Well, I would say a lot of us wildlife managers, as we get older, are deaf, right? Mm. And that, for me, shotguns, and I was a drummer. I mean, if all seriousness, you probably wouldn't want me to hear be out there doing the drumming, you know, rough growth drumming survey. Because, well, I mean, I can be out with friends, and they can say, oh, listen to all the birds. I'm like, well, what birds?
Yeah.
And that bothers me, right?
Yeah.
So, seriously, you're hearing, if you're doing that stuff, folks should recognize that stuff, and you should almost say, hey, I can no longer do this.
But, right.
Yeah, I mean, to your point on August roadside survey, having, you know, good vision is important because a lot of times you're seeing just that little chick head all the grass.
Yeah.
You know, and I think our more experience, I mean, I think in the years I was doing it, you're not looking for a full pheasant. You're looking for that little signature, right? Just that little thing that doesn't look quite right down the road, you know? And I can drive around with friends and point out, well, look at the deer, look at the turkey. And they're like, huh, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, because I'm looking for
that
stuff,
and
you're in tune for that shape, that something's not right in that field. Oh, that's a turkey in the corner. Same thing with the August roadside survey. I think our staff kind of get in tune to being good observers. You know, back to the semantics of it, it's a very, you know, a short window of opportunity in early August. And why August? Well, there's a few things there. Number one, that's where the chicks are getting of age, where they should be out being mobile enough, moving a little bit more. And why they're on the roads is because you want to run these where you got a wet, heavy dew. Okay. That, to me, is the most important aspect of this. Clear skies, light wind, and the heavy dew. And what they do is when the birds move to the grass, you know, just like us, they don't like being all wet. They want to go out and sun themselves. Mm. And that's why they're on the roads, is because they're getting that full sunlight.
Gotcha.
And starting to get their, you know, their feathers dry, if you will. And then they're picking grit and doing a little bit of insect stuff along the road. So that's why it's a roadside survey.
So it's the night before, during this 2-week window in August, your folks that are in charge of actually executing the routes, they got to look at the forecast, and they're looking for, is it going to be a clear morning? Is the humidity going to be high?
Yep.
And I'm assuming
light winds. Yeah.
Light winds, and they got to get out there at daybreak.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Old dark. Yeah. You got to get out there. We would start running them at sunrise.
Sunrise. And then.
Yeah. So you got to be there. I mean, so.
And it's a 25-mile route. So
25-mile route. And keep in mind, some of our staff got to go, if they didn't bring their vehicle home, you know, they got to go to the office, get their vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they have we have some managers got a 6-county work area, right? So they might be driving for an hour and a half.
Oh, wow.
To get to their starting point.
Okay.
And now what happened when you get to your starting point? So I'll pick on Nicollet work area.
Mm-hmm.
They're in Nicollet, Minnesota. They got to go all the way down to Blue Earth County or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
So in Nicollet, you had a lot of dew. You get down there, and darn it all, the wind is higher. There's no dew.
So
you
do they
turn around and go home?
So they don't do it.
Nope, they shouldn't do it. I mean, really the managers are waiting for that, and that's one critical thing on the form is what does it do? Heavy, moderate, light. Now, they might be down there, and they will run the survey, but they'll just circle that it's a light dew.
Mm.
And that would tell our research folks, really, when you look at, there could be some variability because the fact you didn't have a heavy dew, you maybe didn't have as many pheasants on the roads just because they didn't need to be.
Yeah.
Now, that's some of the noise in there, and that's where the power is, not just that one transect.
Yeah.
But it's all that transects in that south-central zone, and you add them up. And hopefully, you know, we're running them on those good days or those moderate days, so you got that power in there. But there's always been, I would argue, there's been that type of variability going back to 1955. Mm-hmm. And that's where you got to look at this as at the regional scale and then the long-term trend and long-term data sets that we have with that.
This is wonderful because it's what I wanted to come out of this, because I feel like, and I'm guilty of this too, that the first week of September, the Minnesota DNR, whatever state, yeah, right, releases the map,
yeah,
the color-coded map. Yeah. And I'm looking for the brown spots on the map. Brown indicates the highest density of birds, right? And if too often I think we look at these maps and then hang our hat on, oh, it's going to be a disastrous year in Stearns County, because, or it's going to be phenomenal in Brown County. But the reality is what you're talking about. This is an index. It's data that's usable over time, just as a health check. So there's value to it.
Yep.
However, you can't just absolutely, you know, hang your head on it's a disaster of a season or a phenomenal season based on, you know, what could be 4 or 7 25-mile routes in a county, and maybe they got to the last day of August or of the it was, they didn't have any good due days, but they still had to run the route.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, it's like, well, it just wasn't a good day for route. And you know, those are the sleepers, right? Because those are where you could end up finding a ton of birds.
Yeah.
So there's value, but take it for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, that map is super popular with hunters. And like you said, this, I think of all the surveys we do, the August roadside survey in Minnesota is the one that the hunters are most eager to see the results. And it's actually now we got people calling, like, you know, like the next day, like, do you got the data?
They're calling us.
Yeah.
When do you get the roadside count? Well, that's actually coming from the Minnesota DNR.
Yeah, and you know, you have people, you know, media calling in mid-July. What's the pheasant prospect? It's like, oh, let's talk in a few weeks, you know. And you can talk, and I get it as a human. When the days start getting cooler and, you know, you get that little bit of urgency in your blood, the fall's coming, you got to get your home chores done, so you got them off. I get it. And it's good to see the excitement out there. But, yeah, I mean, not to disappoint people, if you take that prospect map with a little grain of salt, we are doing our best to kind of provide where the counts were the highest. But, again, I just stress the power isn't at the county level. It's at that aggregate level. And you can go on look at, our website would have previous reports. So when I'm talking West Central, East Central, South Central, folks kind of know where those different areas are in the state. But by and large, again, we try to, you know, time to weather day. Now, I was on a major unit, right? So I had to live on site. So for me, it was pretty easy. I got out of bed. I just went outside and walked in the grass with my bare feet. If my feet weren't soaked, I went back to bed, right? We're gonna punt and run again for another day. I always felt bad for the folks that had to drive an hour and a half to get there, because I would hear from them. They would, as a regional manager, call me, "Yeah, Dave, I got up early and, you know, drove for an hour and a half. I got down there and it started to rain and
waste of time."
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure they went out and checked WMAs on the way there and did some other work, but you do feel the pressure. There is, you know, time there. And like I said, we don't use this data to set regulations. So as an agency, sometimes we wonder, you know, what we always are looking at, what is this? It's expensive to run this, right? When you look at the personnel time, the fuel, the transportation time, our researchers' time.
Data analysis.
Data analysis is a very expensive survey. And you could argue, well, if you're not using it to set season regulations, what is the value of it, right? And I think of all state agencies, you got to look at that, especially when budgets get tight. Again, if you listen to me, I think people get it. I'm a believer in that long-term data set. And I think that's why we have been still running this since 1955, because of that data set and the power it can bring in. And again, it's more than just pheasants too. So,
you mentioned you've run a number of these personally over the years. Any funny, odd stories that you ever seen a UFO on a roadside survey? Anything odd or wildlife sighting? You ever see a moose or a wolverine or something?
I'm trying to think of unique wildlife. Well, maybe two stories, take them for what they're worth. I mean, I lived on site, right? So I drove this 25, or we had two 25-mile segments on the Lac La Parole unit. So I drove these roads almost every day. And you got to know the pheasant broods pretty well. It's like, I'm going to see every day there would be a pheasant brood there. My story is, but the day that you come to do the August roadside survey, son of a...
It wasn't there.
The broods weren't there. And it's just like, ugh! You know, it was sort of like, it's not that it's a competition to get the most birds, but when you drive there day after day and there's always a hen with 10 chicks, and the morning you come to do the August roadside survey,
they're not there and you can't count them.
You can't count them, right? Huh. You know, and it's sort of like, oh, I know you're there. But it's just, again, that's part of the survey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a one shot. It is what it is. If you're running it on, again, the right day, heavy dew, sunlight, you know, clear skies, low wind, it is what it is. Again, and it's just that. It's an index.
So. Could have been a car that went by 3 minutes in front
of
you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then you don't get it.
Yeah, you know, and then there was one year, I mean, I'm thinking back, we had some high counts. I think there was one year we had over 700 pheasants per 100 miles driven, which was like the highest.
Huh.
And that was, we got to, it was a small grain field with the wheat bale still out, and I think every bale had multiple pheasants. I think just in that one field we had over 100 birds sunning themselves. So we just skewed. You could probably say we blew the charts off that route just because of that one square mile part of that was just gangbuster with birds.
So that's interesting. So, yeah, the birds that you count, they don't necessarily have to be on the road. Most of them are.
Yeah.
If you see them, if they fly across, if they're on a hay bale, check.
Yeah, it would be what you can see. You know, you shouldn't be out there with binoculars, you know, picking. I mean, it's just that with your naked eye, you're just driving down if you see the birds.
Mm.
And with, you know, most of them, like, you know, deer, cranes, it's just a check mark how many. With pheasants, again, it was a brood count. So often with pheasants, you might see a chick, you know, they're kind of, or a chick, they're weaving in and out of the grass. You might see the hen dart into the grass. Well, then you'd get up there quick. You would get out, and then you would clap your hand, run down into a ditch, clap your hand, try to flush the birds, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then there's the hen, right? So, so for pheasants, you'd get out and then flush and try to get a really good brood count. And you knew sometimes if there was a cornfield, a little buggers would, you know, run into the cornfield. So then you would mark, you know, brood count incomplete, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, with each of, you couldn't get them all the cornfield and stuff. So, but yeah, for pheasants, you would, again, ideal case, they would all be out on the road and they would take their sweet time, one, you know, crossing the road in front of you or just slowly walking down it. But sometimes if they were like, oh, game on, you know, like I said, then get up there, try to get a flush count and stuff. So,
anything I missed on the roadside count structure before we get kind of a state of the state from you? And we've talked about timing.
I think, Bob, I think we did a pretty good job on the schematics. You know, it's, it's our Medelia, all of our Medelia Farmland Wildlife Research Office. They're the ones that head up this work. So they're the ones that get all the data sheets compiled in, and then they got crunch time where they got to compile all the data and get the report prepared. And, you know, it sounds simple, but there's a lot of eyes on the report, you know.
And that normally comes out like maybe the Tuesday after Labor Day, if I recall correctly. It's early September.
Yeah, it's about time we get them in, the data sheets in, the work up the data. I think you are correct on that and stuff. So,
we've talked rough grouse drumming a couple of times. How does drumming counts for rough grouse differ from August roadside counts? Because as I think about it, they're two pretty distinctly different approaches.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I was thinking about that. I think they both give you an index to population, right? They kind of, you know, up, down. So they both give you that. But with the rough grouse drumming count, it's not really factoring in the production.
Right.
So someday, if you ever want another good podcast, Charlotte, talk with Charlotte Roy, right, our grouse biologist.
Did a podcast with her about sprucies about a year ago.
Okay, yeah. And she, you know, because what we, back to rough grouse, at one time, we felt that would really correlate well with rough grouse drumming counts to what our fall harvest would be. And it was a number of years ago where we were like, hey, you know what? That no longer is doing a good job of predicting what fall harvest would be. Because we would make that, hey, rough grouse drumming counts are up. you know, that could equate to so many rough grouse in the fall, and hunters are coming out saying, yeah, we're just not seeing the birds.
Right.
To your point, what's going on? Right. And that's where, you know, Charlotte started doing research, looking at different disease profiles. And now one thing that we're heading up, and it's been, you know, and for a few years now, now we're going out and asking managers, foresters, everyone who's in the grouse woods to report your rough grouse brood observations, akin to the August roadside survey, because we're trying to figure out, is that brood survey, rough grouse brood survey, going to be a better index to what we have as a fall population going in there? But what it all gets to is that we are noticing rough grouse drumming counts no longer track well with what we have in fall harvest. Something's going on. And that's where we start looking into disease aspects, West Nile virus, other diseases. And then that's where it's like, well, maybe we got looking at brood. And, and again, and that's where I get back to the August roadside value, where it's that early, there's that canary in the coal mine saying there's something going on.
Yeah.
DNR, take a look.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's great. That's great. It makes sense. Drumming counts, adult carryover birds in the springtime.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, it doesn't factor in the broods. So, you know, there's a missing link there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
All right. Give us, you know, I'm not going to have you try to predict the August roadside counts. We'll leave that up to the experts that are out there looking for them. Happening very soon. But give us a state of the state for Minnesota's pheasant population. You know, you talked habitat a number of times. Like, what's your perspective on where we're sitting with habitat? And also, you alluded to going to be looking at a few things when it comes to hunting season, if you're able to share what you might be interested in looking at there.
Yeah, state of the state for pheasants in Minnesota. Where to start, Bob? I think for your listeners, Minnesota is very unique, and we are blessed with an extensive public land system. And actually, next year we'll be celebrating 75 years of our WMA system, and it goes back to 1951 and Save the Wetlands program, where we actually went out there and feed title acquired wetlands to save them from drainage, right? Mm-hmm. And you probably know the story, but for your listeners, that was where we really started our WMA acquisition program, and we built upon that. And so for your listeners, you come out, especially in the western part of the state, we just have a ribbon of network, a wildlife management areas, again, state ownership, and then you got your federal waterfall production areas, you got Nature Conservancy land. So we are working hard. We're adding in, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 acres per year of new WMAs into the system, you know, and hats off to Pheasants Forever, the DUs, the Trust for Public Lands, the Conservation Fund. I should maybe stop naming them because I'm forgetting some important players.
And I think most importantly, thanks to Minnesota voters who passed the legacy.
Well,
too,
exactly.
Because that is an absolute, I mean, our listeners have heard me talk about it. You know, I'm not a native Minnesotan, but the thing that I'm most proud about living in Minnesota is dedicated funding to natural resources through the Legacy Amendment, and it is changing the complexion of habitat in Minnesota.
Yeah, it is. It's been a game changer. I mean, I can look back in my career prior to Legacy Amendment where we would have to have every, you know, we would be out, Pheasants Forever chapters would be putting up $5,000 over here. You know, the Rod and Gun Club would be chipping in another $10,000 just for us to go out and acquire one WMA.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then Pheasants Forever and DU came on, and, you know, we had bonding funds back. But like you said, the power of that legacy amendment were literally, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars are coming into conservation. And we tell our managers, if you can dream it, we'll try to figure out a way to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be, you know, it would take me 5 years to collect enough prairie seed to do one prairie reconstruction. And now we're out and we're able to purchase and harvest seed where we got 60 to 80 different, you know, flower species and grass species out there. And you go out there in the spring, it's just humming alive with insects, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so we are very blessed in that aspect. You know, you go further west, right? They tend to rely on private land access programs. We also have that in Minnesota with our walk-in access program. We hope federal funding continues on that. So on one hand, I look at that, our public lands as being the heartbeat, right? Mm. So, but really to keep that heart pumping, you need to have private conservation. And let's call it what it is. Mm. The Conservation Reserve Program, bar none, has been the biggest conservation program in the farmland area throughout the United States.
Yeah.
See, Conservation Reserve Program is absolutely critical. And we went from, you know, wow, what was it back in the day? Over 30 million acres, and I forget where we're at now, but we are losing CRP acres, and that fate remains unknown. And for your listeners, I always tell people wildlife management is simple. It comes down to habitat. Habitat, habitat, habitat. If you don't have habitat, you're not going to have healthy wildlife populations. I would argue you're not going to have good water quality and all that other things that I think we as humans need to survive and thrive as well. So, again, think of our public lands as the heartbeat, but to maintain that heartbeat, you need to have that private land conservation. We need to reward and give tools to our private landowners to do good things. They want to do good things for the land.
Mm-hmm.
We just got to give them the tools and the funding to go out there and put that habitat on the landscape. So,
yeah, I think about, you know, when I got my very first pup of my own was at 06, 07 time frame. And you know what happened in 06, 07? It was the high point of pheasant harvest in our lifetimes in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And it was directly correlated to that was the peak of CRP.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In the country and also in Minnesota. You know, it was near 36 million acres. And we're, you know, dramatically lower than that, 10 million acres lower than that right now.
Yeah, it's, yeah, and I, you know, I'll, you know, I'll get the data. We were getting concerned with deer. We're going to go on deer a little bit mm-hmm. here, but hopefully we'll come back to your point. But it was like, hey, we're not seeing as many deer in the Southwest, right? There's what's going on. And we looked at it. It was like in some of these counties, we lost 8 square miles of habitat.
Hmm.
And that was CRP that contrasted expired. 8 square miles. And think of that would take us, you know, decades to acquire, generations to acquire that much. And so that's where we started telling deer hunters, well, 8 square miles of habitat, that makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And deer use CRP. Mm-hmm. They use grasslands, you know, just as much as any other species. So that's where you get your listeners that you got to have habitat in the landscape. So excuse me here. But back to your story on pheasants. Al Berner, he was retired Medelia, you know, pheasant researcher, and he flat out said that, well, it's correlated. I mean, for every acre of grass on you add equals one rooster in the bag in the fall.
Mm.
And there is that that correlation that, yeah, you got to have habitat.
If you want your county to look brown, we got to get more CRP on that map.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Anything, I don't want you to let any cat out of the bag that you're not ready for, anything you're looking at from a pheasant hunting perspective in the future?
Well, before we go there real quick, I mean, your listeners, we just at Roundtable last January, we did unveil our pheasant action plan. We got a duck action plan. For those listeners maybe that reside in Minnesota, you can check it out on our Minnesota DNR website. In there we have what our objectives are, our strategies, and our performance indicators. It says what we are going to do to try, if you will, to get more pheasants and more habitat in the landscape.
So as we leave kind of the, you know, the discussion about the state of the state, and it all comes back to habitat, hunting, you know, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned Minnesota's unique in that we have a two rooster limit from the start of the season until the end of November. And then maybe a decade ago, roughly, the law changed and you can hunt pheasants in Minnesota and harvest 3 roosters from December 1st through the end of the season, which is generally the first Sunday in January, like January 1st or January 2nd, depending on where it falls. Any other sort of changes to hunting laws related to pheasants or regulations that you're going to look at in the coming years?
Yeah, we're right now our resident game bird consultant position is vacant, but we're going to be filling that pretty soon. But I know we are going to be, you know, and I think it's the process has started to be surveying our pheasant hunters. It's actually, we're overdue. I mean, I'll bias, we reach out to waterfowl hunters quite a bit. And I like to ask the question one time, like, well, when was the last time we talked to our pheasant hunters and got their survey? And it's like, you know, it's been a while since we're doing that. Because, Bob, to your point, we are hearing interest from folks to really look at our season structure. And a few things that come up, South Dakota did it. What about the idea of hunting birds into January, right? I'm sure that'll elicit strong emotions, but let's have that conversation with our pheasant hunters and that, you know, through a survey. Other one that comes up, you know, is the 9 o'clock start time. And my understanding that was set up to not be knocking on the farmer's door at old dark 30 for permission to hunt. Well, I don't think we got to worry about that too much anymore.
Right? Yeah.
So at 9 o'clock, I don't think that's really rooted in any kind of biology. It was more of a social thing. So they're not knocking at farmers' doors early in the morning. Well, what about starting to hunt them at, you know, sunrise? And again, strong, I'm sure they'll bring strong passion. People will be like, wow, no, I want to sleep in. 9 o'clock's fine. Other people, and the same thing with January, would be like, wow, no, birds. And, you know, so we all have our opinions. And I will say in wildlife management, we were talking about, I think, before the podcast started, the biology issues are pretty easy for our agency to tackle. It's the human dimension stuff that gives us the most problems.
Yeah.
Deer management is one where deer biology, I would argue, is easy. It's the human factor and everyone's intense interest and passion. Same with bless our waterfowl hunters. That's a very passionate group, and pheasant hunters are too. So anytime you talk about these social changes, you get into that human dimension. And I think that's where we do have a human dimensions team. And we are doing a better job at looking at that social human dimension aspects and the survey work and how to interpret that data to help us navigate that minefield of human emotions that come into wildlife management.
Awesome. Thank you for being so forthcoming and honest about sharing. Because I've often wondered, in any given year, I'll have 7 to 10 hunting licenses. And I'm primarily an upland hunter, right? Seven to 10 states. From, you know, New Mexico to Montana. And I've always wondered, okay, in Nebraska I can hunt, I think it's like a half hour before sunrise, right? In North Dakota, same thing. South Dakota, you know, I cross the border and I can't start till 10. You go to Iowa and it's 8, but you got to be done by 4. You go to Minnesota and it's 9. Like, what? What's the reasoning here?
Yeah.
So that's, I really appreciate you guys looking at, okay, what's the science and what is, you know, what's the population want? Is it 9 a.m.? Maybe it is.
Yeah.
But maybe it's 8.
I mean, I think back in the days of waterfowl where we had the 12 noon opener and we went to 9 o'clock and I thought the world, myself, what are we doing? The world's going to come to an end. You know, it didn't come to an end. That was 9 o'clock. And some people could argue it is. But then again, we went to a half an hour on opening day. I think we are so ingrained in tradition.
Yeah.
And so anytime you're talking about changing, that goes back to turkeys too. We used to, you know, hunt them to noon, and people liked it, right? They could go back to camp, sit there and tell stories, and then I think it was the idea of that, well, if I gotta hunt all day, then that means I could be out there hunting all day. What do you mean? I want to take a nap and not feel guilty about it. So I think you gotta ask those questions.
I think you're right, because the start time, I think it is tradition, because you're only racing towards two roosters.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you start at 8 or start at 9, once you get to 2, you're done. Right. Yeah. So what's the difference? I do think it's very interesting, the January conversation, because I believe that does open it up a more science biology oriented conversation. Because in years where winter's hard and you're pushing, you know, your dogs through the best cover, you are going to displace hens.
yep.
that are in good cover, and you could make them vulnerable. Now, granted, you're not shooting those hens. You're just shooting the roosters, and you can make the argument, well, you're eliminating additional roosters out of the population and allowing hens to have better quality cover and better quality
yeah.
food, right? So there's a give and take there, but let's let the science dictate that. I think, and as opposed to the start time, it's like, well, that's societal. There's no, I don't know. That there's a whole lot of science.
You're right. I mean, I think on the January, and you're going to, you know, this isn't the Minnesota DNR talking. It's kind of Dave as a pheasant hunter, right? It's a biological question. I think what I look at it, we got to be managing for good winter cover for pheasants, resident birds. So you have that aspect, and I am concerned about disturbance across our WMA system, just with you know disturbance during all times of the year. You know, you know some of the you know debates I've had with people on. They'd be like, "Well, Dave, you know, if it's a bad winter, deep snow and cold, I'm not going to be out there pheasant hunting
right,
anyways."
Right.
And I think there's some truth to that. I mean, when you got to go up to snowdrifts up to your waist,
right.
Your enthusiasm for pheasant hunting goes downhill pretty quick.
You got to watch the Packers.
Yeah, exactly. Because they'll be in the playoffs. Vikings won't be. Yeah. Anyway, so maybe it would be that they would say that it's those open winters where pheasants aren't stressed, that we would be able to take advantage of that time, again, where the story began with my dad and grandpa and my brothers all pheasant hunting, right?
Yeah.
So this sad aspect of getting people outdoors. So, again, it's a little bit of biology, a little bit of human dimensions work, and that's where I think we've got to really look at that survey. Help us inform it, then as an agency, you get together, look at the data, and make the decisions we can. And you can always adjust, too.
Yeah. So. Fabulous. Thank you for all the forthright information and inviting me into your home, your brand-new home.
Yeah,
so I really appreciate this.
Oh, you're welcome, Bob. It's been fun.
Awesome. From the Minnesota DNR, that's Dave Trauba. I'm Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.